December 12th, 2023 of the Common Era. The time is 16:53 hours Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you. Uh-oh, the camera's stopped on me. Let me see if I can get this running again here. It's not running. That's better, I think. Yeah, it seems to be working now. But like I said, now it's 16:54 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm glad to see you again today, and I hope you're doing well. I am with you, Ward Green, ready to do the study for this December 12th, 2023, and we're studying The Crucible of Credible Creed, Chapter 1, Paragraph 12, the very final paragraph of the first chapter of our most instructive or most important article, perhaps, of the entire series, although they all have merit that's immeasurable. And this is a very short paragraph. It just says, rather than using archaeology to prejudge God, for example, the way that the archaeologists did when they excavated at Jericho and concluded that the Israelites were never at Jericho because they couldn't find evidence in the time or of the time for which they were looking, you know. And they ended up dating Jericho to a time that they didn't believe was consistent. That is, they dated the fall of Jericho to a time that they didn't believe was consistent with the Bible account of Joshua. But that's just one example, and there are many examples where the archaeology does strongly agree with the Bible, or certainly is not inconsistent in any way, you know, in many other cases. So, but rather than using archaeology to prejudge God in the way that people do when they put archaeology before God, we might go in a different direction, which uses a different question. And that question is, how can the Bible account for the known world and history? How can the Bible account for the known world and history? And that's what we're going to study in the remainder of this article, which is, there are now 11 chapters remaining. That's all for today's study. We've got a fair bit to read today, so we should move on. Our proverb for today, little children, is from Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 4. Whenever you vow a vow to God, do not hesitate to pay it. For there is no delight in the stupid ones. What you vow, pay. Very important principle. In other words, making your word important. Being true to your word, even if it's not a vow, you can be true to your word. When you say something, when you say you're going to do something, you shouldn't then not do it. You should always do what you say you're going to do. And that shouldn't be any exception. You know, I mean, sometimes you want to, if you want to change what you said, then you can do that through, you know, by, if you told somebody something, you made a promise, you can always go and, you know, or if you made an agreement with them, more importantly. But your promises you should keep too, but you're not legally obligated to keep your promises. But if you've been, you know, bound to somebody by some kind of contract through an oral expression that you spoke, by which always has a two-way aspect. So if you promise to do something in exchange for something else, that's an oral contract, as long as it's a substantial trade either way. That's a legal contract, but you can speak. And there's another thing that says that, you know, if you're, storm your fellow man with importunities if you've promised something that you don't think you can deliver, or if you've completely changed your mind about wanting to do that particular thing. I think that's from possibly, I'm spending too long on this. I just have to look up that word. I think it might be Proverbs. Yeah, it's Proverbs 6. Right, if you've gone surety for your fellow man, if you've given your handshake even to the stranger, if you have been ensnared by the sayings of your mouth, if you've been caught by the sayings of your mouth, then storm your fellow man with importunities, verse 3, right? You need to get yourself out. Do not, out of the contract, do not give any sleep to your eyes. Be very, very, eager and insistent on releasing yourself from something that you don't want to be a part of. So that's another thing. But generally, you should always try to keep your word in everything you say. Not just what you promise, but just anything you say you're going to do. And it came about at the return of the year, 2 Samuel 11, at the time that kings sally forth. That's how we know that this is the time when kings sally forth, which is the springtime, the return of the year. We know that because of this scripture here in 2 Samuel 11. And it came about that David proceeded at that time to send Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, that they might bring the sons of Ammon to ruin and lay siege to Rabbah while David was dwelling in Jerusalem. And it came about at the time of evening that David proceeded to rise from his bed and walk about on the rooftop of the king's house. And from the rooftop he caught sight of a woman bathing herself. And the woman was very good in appearance. Then David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" After that, David sent messengers that he might take her. So she came in to him, and he lay down with her while she was sanctifying herself from her uncleanness. Later she returned to her house. So David did a wrong thing, very wrong, a bad thing, a wrong thing. He took a married woman, and the woman became pregnant. Verse 5, consequently she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." At this David sent to Joab, saying, "Send to me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David began to ask how Joab was getting along and how the people were getting along and how the war was getting along. Finally, David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and bathe your feet." Accordingly, Uriah went out from the king's house, and the king's courtesy gift went out following him. However, Uriah lay down at the entrance of the king's house with all the other servants of his lord, and he did not go down to his own house. So they told David, saying, "Uriah did not go down to his own house." Upon that, David said to Uriah, "It is from a journey that you've come in, is it not? Why have you not gone down to your own house?" At this, Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are dwelling in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping on the face of the field. And I, shall I go into my own house to eat and drink and to lie down with my wife? As you are living and as your soul is living, I shall not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Dwell here also today, and tomorrow I shall send you away." Therefore Uriah kept dwelling in Jerusalem on that day and the day following. Further, David called him that he might eat before him and drink. So he got him drunk. Nevertheless, he went out in the evening to lie down on his bed with the servants of his lord, and to his own house he did not go down. And it came about in the morning that David proceeded to write a letter to Joab and send it by the hand of Uriah. So he wrote in the letter, saying, "Put Uriah in front of the heaviest battle charges, and you men must retreat from behind him, and he must be struck down and die." And it came about that while Joab was keeping guard over the city, he kept Uriah put in the place where he knew that there were valiant men. When the men of the city came on out and went fighting against Joab, then some of the people, the servants of David, fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Joab now sent that he might report to David all the matters of the war, and he went on to command the messenger, saying, "As soon as you finish speaking to the king about all the matters of the war, then it must occur that if the rage of the king comes up and he does say to you, 'Why did you have to go so near to the city to fight? Did you men not know that they would shoot from on top of the wall? Who was it that struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaasheth? Was it not a woman that pitched an upper millstone upon him from on top of the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you men have to go so close to the wall? You must also say, your servant Uriah the Hittite died too.' So the messenger went and came and told David all about which Joab had sent him. And the messenger went on to say to David, 'The men proved superior to us, so that they came out against us into the field. But we kept pressing them right up to the entrance of the gate. And the shooters kept shooting at your servants from on top of the wall, so that some of the servants of the king died, and your servant Uriah the Hittite also died.' At that David said to the messenger, 'This is what you will say to Joab: Do not let this matter appear bad in your eyes, for the sword eats up one as well as another. Intensify your battle against the city and throw it down, and encourage him.' And the wife of Uriah got to hear that Uriah, her husband, had died, and she began to wail over her owner. When the mourning period was past, David immediately sent and took her home to his house, and she came to be his wife. In time she bore to him a son. But the thing that David had done appeared bad in the eyes of Jehovah." And that's the end of 2 Samuel 11. So David added a far worse sin to his first sin of adultery, in that he ordered Uriah to be killed in the battle. So he essentially murdered a man. That's just it's the worst sin, you know, that you can commit, probably, of all the sins. But it's a bad sin, and David did it to hide the fact that he had gotten Uriah's wife pregnant. But how did she know she was pregnant? That doesn't come really into the story. And how is it that he was that she got pregnant and knew so quickly that while he was at battle? That, I mean, she had only had such a short time since she had been with David, that David believed that he could get Uriah to have relations with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, at such a time that David would then be no longer the suspect as being the father. So it's that part of the story is not really explained at all. It's very curious, and the more I think about it, the more I try to understand it. It just depends how long the battle was going on, for one thing, but also how long would it take her to know she was pregnant. And then she must have known very soon, which implies they must have had a way of determining that a woman was pregnant that we don't know about, apparently. That's what it sounds like. 46 of Jeremiah. This is what occurred as the word of Jehovah to Jeremiah the prophet concerning the nations: for Egypt, concerning the military force of Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, we saw that the prophecy about Pharaoh Hophra came true, because his own successor caused the end, the premature end of Pharaoh Hophra, so that the prophecy about Pharaoh Hophra in Jeremiah, where was it? 44 and 30, I think. Yeah, 44 and 30. This prophecy about Hophra, that Jehovah was giving Hophra into the hand of his enemies, that came true. And now, In Jeremiah 46, we have this, again, this is a chronological important marker here, or a flag, or a, you know, a what do we call a milestone in the chronology. The military force of Pharaoh, who happened to be Pharaoh Necho, by the river Euphrates at Carchemish, whom Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Babylon, defeated in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah. In the fourth year of Jehoiakim, there was a battle at Carchemish, and this is the only source that I know of about this, or that anyone knows of, as far as I'm aware, about this battle in the year 605. Or very close to the year 605 BCE, that was conducted there by Nebuchadrezzar, or Nebuchadnezzar, as he's also called, against Pharaoh Necho. And Nebuchadrezzar defeated Necho in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. It's remarkable because that is not known by anyone else. So the Bible gives us that information. Very importantly, and we can calculate what year it was based on calculating back from 587 when Jerusalem was destroyed, or even from 597 when the son of Jehoiakim was taken captive after ruling for only 3 months. So from 597 we can add the 11 years of Jehoiakim, or Jehoiakim, to get to 608, and that's his year 1, and then we say 605 is his year 4. It works out very well to, because we're so close to calculate back from a date that's so close in time. It's only from 587, we only have to calculate back 19 years, 18 years? Yeah, 18 years from 687 to 605. Right. 1813, that's right. 18 minus 13 is 5. So set in array, O men. Verse 3, buckler and large shield and approach to battle. This is what Jeremiah the prophet said. Harness. This is what the word of Jehovah was, harness the horses and mount, O you horsemen, and station yourselves with the helmet. Polish the lances, clothe yourselves with coats of mail. Why is it that I have seen them terror-stricken? They are turning back, and their mighty men themselves are crushed to pieces, and they have positively fled, and they have not turned around. There's fright all around, is the utterance of Jehovah. Let not the swift one try to flee, and let not the mighty man try to escape. Up north, by the bank of the river Euphrates, they have stumbled and fallen. Oh, look, it sounds like that's where they had the battle, right? It was up north. That was where it happened, at Carchemish. So this is referring to that. Who is this one that comes up just like the Nile River, like the rivers, the waters of which toss themselves? Egypt itself comes up just like the Nile River. And like rivers, the waters toss themselves. And it says, I shall go up, I shall cover the earth, I shall readily destroy the city and those inhabiting it. Go up, O you horses, and drive madly, O you chariots, and let the mighty men go forth, Cush and Put, who are handling the shield, and the Ludim, who are handling and treading the bow. And that day belongs to the sovereign Lord Jehovah of armies, the day of vengeance for avenging himself upon his adversaries. And the sword will certainly devour and satisfy itself and take its fill for their blood, of their blood, for the sovereign Lord Jehovah of armies has a sacrifice in the land of the north by the river Euphrates. Go up to Gilead and get some balsam, O virgin daughter of Egypt. In vain you have multiplied the means of healing. There is no mending for you. The nations have heard your dishonor, and your own outcry has filled the land. For they have stumbled, mighty man against mighty man. Together they have fallen down, both of them. The word that Jehovah spoke to Jeremiah the prophet as regards the coming of Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Babylon, to strike down the land of Egypt. Tell it in Egypt, O men, and publish it in Migdol, and publish it in Noph, and in Tophanes. Say, station yourself, make preparation also for yourself, for a sword will certainly devour all around you. Why is it that your powerful ones have been washed away? They have made no stand. For Jehovah himself has pushed them away. In great numbers they are stumbling. They also actually fall, and they keep saying one to the other, do rise up and do let us return to our people and to the land of our relatives because of the maltreating sword. Let's see if we have anything here. There's nothing in our research that we can look up here about Nebuchadnezzar in Egypt, but I think it's true that Nebuchadnezzar did go down to Egypt. I think that is true. We'll research that for next time if we can. Do rise up and do let us return to our people and to the land of our relatives because of the maltreating sword. There they have proclaimed, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, is a mere noise. He has let the festal time pass by. As I am alive is the utterance of the king, whose name is Jehovah of armies. Like Tabor among the mountains and like Carmel by the sea, he will come in. Make for yourself mere baggage for exile, O inhabitress, the daughter of Egypt. For Noph, or Noph, itself will become a mere object of astonishment and will actually be set afire, so as to be without an inhabitant. Egypt is as a very pretty heifer. From the north, a mosquito itself will certainly come against her. Furthermore, her hired soldiers in the midst of her are like fattened calves. Just realized I can probably make something sound a little quieter here. If I try, I can probably... Yeah. From the north, a mosquito itself will certainly come against her. Furthermore, her hired soldiers in the midst of her are like fattened calves. But they themselves also have given way. They have fled together. They have not made a stand, for the very day of their disaster has come in upon them, the time of their being given attention. Her voice is like that of a serpent that goes along, for with vital energy men will go, and with axes they will actually come in to her, like those who are gathering pieces of wood. They will certainly cut down her forest, is the utterance of Jehovah, for it could not be penetrated. For they have become more numerous than the locusts, and they are without number. The daughter of Egypt will certainly feel shame. She will actually be given into the hand of the people of the north. Jehovah of armies, the God of Israel, has said, here I am turning my attention upon Ammon, from No, and upon Pharaoh, and upon Egypt, and upon her gods, and upon her kings, even upon Pharaoh, and upon all those trusting in him. And I will give them into the hand of those seeking for their soul, and into the hand of Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants, and afterward she will be resided in, as in the days of old, is the utterance of Jehovah. And as for you, do not be afraid, O my servant Jacob, and do not be terror-stricken, O Israel. For here I am saving you from far away, and your offspring from the land of their captivity. And Jacob will certainly return, and have no disturbance, and be at ease, and without anyone causing trembling. As for you, do not be afraid, O my servant Jacob, is the utterance of Jehovah. This is verse 28, for I am with you. For I shall make an extermination among all the nations to which I have dispersed you, but with you I shall make no extermination. Yet I shall have to chastise you to the proper degree, and I shall absolutely not leave you unpunished. That's the end of Jeremiah 46. I wonder if we can look at let's look at the study Bible here. Where it says that there's going to be an invasion of Nebuchadnezzar to strike down the land of Egypt, if we go to the study Bible. And we look... There's no research there either. Okay. All right. Where are we? Let's go back. Okay, so let's go to our next portion of reading for today's Matthew 20. For the kingdom of the heavens is like a man, a householder, who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. This is Jesus continuing the story about how many that are first would be last and the last first. When he had agreed with the workers for a denarius a day, he sent them forth into his vineyard. A denarius is a Roman silver coin that weighed 3.85 grams. He sent them forth into his vineyard. Going out also about the third hour, he saw others standing unemployed in the marketplace. This is the householder. And to those he said, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is just I will give you. So off they went. Again he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour and did likewise. Finally, about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing, and he said to them, why have you been standing here all day unemployed? They said to him, because nobody has hired us. He said to them, you too go into the vineyard. When it became evening, the master of the vineyard said to his man in charge, call the workers and pay them their wages, proceeding from the last to the first. When the 11th hour men came, they each received a denarius. They were paid first, you notice? So when the first came, they concluded they would receive more, but they also received pay at the rate of a denarius. On receiving it, they began to murmur against the householder and said, these last put in 1 hour's work. Still you made them equal to us, who bore the burden of the day and the burning heat. But in reply to one of them, he said, fellow, I do you no wrong. You agreed with me for a denarius, did you not? Take what is yours and go. I want to give to this last one the same as to you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I want with my own things? Or is your eye wicked because I am good? In this way, the last ones will be first, and the first ones last, Jesus continued. And that was the end of that story. And it's a parable, of course. It's an illustration to show how it would be with regard to the payment of everlasting life and the reward of being received into the kingdom of God. Being now about to go up to Jerusalem, verse 17, Jesus took the 12 disciples off privately and said to them on the road, look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will deliver him up to men of the nations to make fun of and to scourge and to impale, and the third day he will be raised up. Jesus keeps on talking about this repeatedly, it seems, does it not? But also, in this case, he mentions how they're going to make fun of him. That's something that we know does come true, but it's really fascinating that is it not fascinating that Jesus knows this in advance? Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee, verse 20, approached him with her sons, doing obeisance and asking for something from him. He said to her, what do you want? She said to him, give the word that these my two sons may sit down, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom. Jesus said in answer, you men do not know what you are asking for. Can you drink the cup that I am about to drink? They said to him, we can. He said to them, you will indeed drink my cup, but this sitting down at my right hand and at my left is not mine to give, but it belongs to those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. When the 10 others heard of this, they became indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus, it'd be James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they were the two brothers. Jesus calling the other disciples to him said, you know that the rulers of the nations lord it over them, and the great men wield authority over them. This is not the way among you, but whoever wants to become great among you must be your minister, and whoever wants to be first among you must be your slave, just as the Son of Man came not to be ministered to, but to minister, and to give his soul a ransom in exchange for many. Now, as they were going out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And look, two blind men sitting beside the road when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out, saying, Lord, or Jesus, have mercy on us, Son of David. The Vulgate, for example, the Sinaitic manuscript. The Sinaitic manuscript says Jesus. Yeah. That's the one that has, if I'm reading the footnote there correctly, I think that's what that is, the Sinaitic manuscript. It's represented by the symbol Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet the key code, what you want to call it, the legend, the symbolic letters that are used for references. So, Lord is used by a number of the manuscripts, including the Vulgate. And I think it's the Alexandrian manuscript number 1201, the Vatican manuscript 1209, that's what it is, also. And some other ones, I don't remember what they are. Papyrus Fuad number 45 also, it uses the name Lord. But there are two manuscripts that omit this phrase of Lord or Jesus. Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. But the crowd sternly told them to keep silent, yet they cried all the louder, saying, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. But some of them, some of the manuscripts, or one of the manuscripts said, Jesus, have mercy on us, Son of David, for the first time that they spoke. Then they said the second time, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. So Jesus stopped, called them, and said, what do you want me to do for you? They said to him, Lord, let our eyes be opened. Moved with pity, Jesus touched their eyes, and immediately they received sight, and they followed him. It's the end of our reading of Matthew chapter 20, and we have 1 minute left. A little less now than 1 minute. That's quite a fortuitous eventuality, the way that worked out in the end, because we had a lot to read today compared to some days, but less than other days, of course. So, I had a busy day today. I did a lot of work today. At least I spent 6 hours doing it, even though it didn't end up being a lot of work. It was difficult work, and it was a good physical exercise to do it also. I had to crawl around in a rather confined space, climbing up and down a ladder, and that's all for today. I am glad that I got the study done. I'm glad you joined us, and I hope to see you again. I would like to say it is December 12th, so just in conclusion here. The year is 2023 of the Common Era. The time is 1726 hours Eastern Standard Time. And, yes, on my behalf, well, I love you. I love you very much. On my behalf, it is Gully and Cassie saying bye for now.